In this session, New York Times best-selling author and international lecturer Michael Hingson demonstrates that overcoming the challenges and adversities of blindness is all about overcoming a misguided attitude about blindness. Michael's talk, wherein he describes how he and his guide dog survived the attack on the World Trade Center, was the keynote speech at Visions 2013, sponsored by the Foundation Fighting Blindness. The recording has been selected and edited especially for presentation to the International Low Vision Support Group.
Thank you for that introduction. I am Michael Hingson, the author of Thunder Dog, The Story of a Guide Dog, A Blind Man, and the Triumph of Trust. The story is about me surviving in the World Trade Center. And at the time of 9/11, my guide dog was Roselle. Since 9/11, I have traveled the world speaking and talking about lessons of 9/11, talking about trust and teamwork, moving from diversity to inclusion, mostly talking about life. As I look at the questions that people ask on a regular basis, there are two that are very common. People who have read Thunder Dog say, "You rode a bicycle? How did you do that?" The other question that is asked of me on a regular basis is, if you had the chance to regain your sight, would you do it? I want to talk about that because I think that it's not only a fair question, it's a question that really goes to the heart of everything that I believe in and everything that I talk about. So to answer the question, I'm going to tell you about my experiences and then come back and give you the answer, which I think you may be able to guess by then, but maybe not, because the answer may surprise you. I went to Guide Dogs for the Blind in November of 1999 and got Roselle, a Labrador Retriever, a fun-loving, cute lab who fit my requirements at the time. When Guide Dogs for the Blind asked what I wanted, I said, I want a dog with an on-off switch, a dog that knows how to focus and knows how to play when the time is right. And Roselle was perfect for that. So in 1999, I got Roselle. And in August of 2000, we opened a new full regional office for Quantum on the 78th floor of Tower 1 of the World Trade Center. 78 floors is pretty high, although the building was 110 stories tall. The building was so high that on the 4th of July, people would come to our office to look down on the fireworks displays in New York. We opened the office. I had staff. I followed my procedure of knowing everything I could about how to get around. I knew everything about what to do if there was an emergency because I took the time. On September 11th, 2001, we were going to be having a special series of seminars for employees of other companies who worked with us, our resellers, to teach them how to sell our products. These employees were to come in and be part of one of four seminars. I got in about 7:40 in the morning. I had planned to be there earlier, but things never go as you plan. I got to my office, and about the time I got there, a person from the Port Authority cafeteria on the 44th floor arrived, and he was there to bring food that we had ordered. He came in and set up. I started working with people to get everything set up, and finally, all was ready. Some early arrivals had come. David Frank from our corporate office had come. David was there because he had account responsibility for some of the people who were in that day, and we were ready. Our guests were eating. At 8:45 in the morning, David and I were in my office doing some final preparations for the seminars, and suddenly we heard a muffled explosion. The building started to shake, and then the building started to tip. It just started tipping and tipping and tipping. We literally moved about 20 feet. But we didn't know at the time that buildings like that are big, tall springs, and they're made to be able to be buffeted and actually be hit by an airplane, like the Empire State Building was in the 1940s. The building kept tipping. David and I were talking about it. What's going on? We had some early arrivals. There were five people in our conference room. They were just there being very quiet. David and I said, "What's happening?" And finally, David and I said goodbye to each other because we thought we were about to take a 78-floor plunge to the street below. And then the building stopped. I should tell you that David was holding on to my desk. Roselle was asleep under my desk at the time, and we left her there. And David stayed where he was. I was where I was. The building stopped. We held our breath, and then suddenly it slowly started moving back the other way. And the building kept moving and moving, and finally it got to a vertical position. And as soon as it did, I went back into the office, and I met Roselle coming out from under my desk. I took her leash, and I told her to come around on my left side by giving her the command to heel and to sit, which is exactly what she did. And about that time, the building dropped straight down about 6 feet. Now, the physics of the situation was, although we didn't think about it at the time, only did later, hey, it was a spring, right? The spring went back to its normal configuration, and that's what the building did. But we didn't know that at the time. All I know is that as soon as the building stopped moving, David released his hold on my desk, turned around and started shouting, "Oh my God, Mike, there's fire and smoke and millions of pieces of burning paper outside our window. They're falling. The building's on fire. We got to get out of here right now." And I said, "Slow down, David." "No, no, no, we got to get out of here right now." Our guests began to scream. They started moving toward our exits. "Slow down, David. We got to get out of here right now." And again, I said, "David, hold on, slow down. We'll get out." And then finally the big line. "You don't understand. You can't see it." I heard the paper falling outside the window. I wasn't smelling smoke, but I believed David. You're not going to make that up. The building tipped, for heaven's sakes. All of that happened. I believed him. But I was observing something that David wasn't, because I was seeing things that he wasn't prepared to look at. I saw sitting next to me a dog who was wagging her tail and yawning and not giving any indication at all that she was afraid. You've read stories about animals that got their humans out of buildings because they sensed fire or something ahead of the humans. Roselle wasn't giving me any of those indications. I'd been working with guide dogs at that point for 37 years. I knew the process. I knew what to expect from the dog. And if she was afraid of something, I would have known it. And she wasn't giving me any indication of fear whatsoever. That told me, by definition, that at that point in time, we could try to evacuate without panic. I finally got David to focus, and I said, "Get our guests to the stairs. Take them to the stairs. Then you come back, and we'll leave." And he did. I called my wife, Karen. It was about 8:47 in the morning, long before the media got the story. I said, "There'd been an explosion or something in the building, and we have to get out." And so we did. David came back. We swept the offices. We went to the stairs, and we started down. Almost immediately, I began smelling an odor, and I realized this is a familiar thing. I'm not sure what it is, but I smelled it before. It took me a while to realize that I was smelling the fumes from burning jet fuel. I did a lot of travel for my company. I've been to lots of airports. It took me a while, but I realized, I'm smelling burning jet fuel. We must have been hit by an airplane. And I observed that to people around me, and they went, "Yeah, you're right." Now, it's funny. I've had countless interviews by the press and talked to countless people about this, and they said, "Well, of course you didn't know what happened. You couldn't see what happened." Excuse me. The airplane hit on the 96th floor on the north side of the building. We're on the south side of the building on the 78th floor. Nobody saw it because the last time I heard about anything like that, we had never invented Superman's X-ray vision for real. No one knew. It had nothing to do with blindness. So we went down the stairs. We passed and were passed by burn victims. We traveled down. And finally, at one point, David said, "Mike, we're going to die. We're not going to make it out of here." And I just said, "Stop it, David. If Roselle and I can go down these stairs, so can you." And I deliberately snapped at him in my best teacher's voice because I wanted him to snap out of whatever he was doing. We didn't need panic on the stairs. And David did. He told me later that that brought him out of his funk. And you know what he did? He did one of the most incredible things, I think one of the most heroic and certainly innovative things of 9/11. And he never gets a lot of credit for it. David walked away from me. He walked down a whole floor below me and then suddenly started shouting out whatever he saw on the stairs. "Hey, I'm on the 48th floor. Everything is good here. 47th floor, no problems. I don't see any obstacles. Everything is good." He was shouting up to me to give me advance warning of anything, but he was acting as an advance scout for the hundreds of people above him and even the people below him who could hear his voice. He gave them something to focus on. He helped thousands of people, I believe, not panic, and never knew it, at least at the time. wasn't why he was doing it. He was just doing it for me. Meanwhile, I'm a floor above him, and I'm telling Roselle forward to go down 10 steps, then turn left and left again, and then go down forward 9 stairs, left, left, forward down 10 stairs, left, left, forward down 9 stairs. I'm sitting there going, wait a minute, I see a pattern here. We're 19 stairs between floors. Ooh, I wonder, how many stairs are we going to go down? I had to have something to keep my mind active because I was worried too. I was focusing on Roselle, and I knew I had to sound confident for her because I didn't want her to think I was worried. Because if she did, she'd start looking back at me, are you okay? And I needed her to focus. But also, I was really concerned because people were not going to know what to do if we started to have a problem. We had power and lighting on the stairs. And I knew that all my light-dependent friends would really have a world of challenge if the lights went out. And so I said to them, in my best flight attendant voice, now if the power and lights go out, I don't want anyone to worry, and I spoke loud enough for anybody who could hear me, who would be able to and would focus, would do so. I said, look, if the power and lights go out, don't anybody worry. My name is Mike. I've got my guide dog, Roselle, here. I'm blind. Don't worry. We're offering a half price special to get you out today only. I knew that some people really would listen to that, and if we really did have a problem, they would be able to go, oh, wait a minute, the blind guy's here. And we would be able to keep order and get people out, and we would. We didn't have the problem. We got to the 30th floor. Firefighters started coming up the stairs. We met them. They stopped and they said, hey, we're going to send somebody down with you. And I said, no, you don't need to do that. I just came down from the 78th floor to not prolong it. We had a long discussion and I really didn't want their help. I didn't want somebody to grab me by the arm and be trying to lift me up as I'm walking down the stairs and all those sorts of things. And I didn't need that help. And I finally said, look, I got my sighted friend here. It was the only way to convince him. David and I are walking down the stairs together. We're good, because at that time I'd gone down to where he was. And the firefighters let us by. I told them I had my guide dog and she was going to help us, and you know, before they finally left, and they started petting her. Roselle started giving kisses. You know, I didn't give them a lecture about this isn't the time to pet a guide dog, the dog's in harness. I also didn't try to give them a lecture about, you know, let's talk about the real issues about concerning blindness, you know. I just dealt with it and they went on, and as the first fire guy left, before he did, he petted Roselle one more time. Roselle gave him some kisses and then he was gone, possibly having received the last piece of unconditional love he ever got in his life. Now, I didn't want their help, mostly because they're a team, and I didn't want to break up their team. I didn't want it on my conscience that somebody wasn't where they were supposed to be if the firefighters had a problem. We went down, we got to the bottom, we got outside, and then we left the World Trade Center complex. We went over to Broadway and we started going north on Broadway and we got to Ann Street, which put us diagonally right across from Tower 2. And we were there when suddenly Tower 2 collapsed, 100 yards away from us, and it's a 400-yard tall building. Tower 2 collapsed, David ran, everybody started running. I took Roselle and bodily lifted her up, turned around and started running myself back the way I came, now running back toward Fulton Street. And as we ran, Roselle focused. I worked with her. We kept running. We got to Fulton Street. We turned right on Fulton Street, caught up to David. David had stopped realizing that he had left, and he apologized when I showed up. He said, I was going to come back and get you. And I said, don't worry about it. Let's keep going. And we ran, and then we got engulfed in the dust cloud, all the dirt and debris from Tower 2 collapsing. We started inhaling all that dirt and junk, which still affects me today. But we ran into that, and we kept running, and realized we had to get out of that dust cloud because we were starting to suffocate. We kept looking for an opening on my right-hand side. I kept telling Roselle, right, right, right. I was listening for an opening, and suddenly I heard it. And I turned right into the opening. Roselle turned. She took one step, and then she stopped dead, and she wouldn't move. Now, I'd been focusing and working with her. She wasn't acting afraid, but she stopped. There must have been a reason. I reached out a foot, and I reached out and looked at the wall, and lo and behold, she had stopped at the top of a flight of stairs. She did her job perfectly. We went down and we were in the area for about 10 minutes or so. Then a police officer came and said, you had to leave. We went with him up and out and discovered that Tower 2 was gone. I can only describe the sound of the tower falling as kind of a freight train and a waterfall sound, the glass tinkling and breaking, and then the clatter of metal, and then the white noise of the building collapsing. Now it was gone. I asked David, what do you see? And he said, all I see are pillars of fire and smoke hundreds of feet tall. We turned west on Fulton and continued to walk for a while. And then suddenly we heard that freight train waterfall sound again, and we knew it was our tower collapsing. We were far enough away that we thought we were safe from debris, but David looked and saw another dust cloud coming, and so we ran to get out of its way. And after it passed, we opened our eyes, and David looked and said, oh my God, there's no World Trade Center anymore. I had tried to call Karen when we were standing at Ann Street, and I wasn't able to get through, so now I tried again, and this time I got through. And she's the one who told us that two aircraft had deliberately been crashed by terrorists into the towers, one into the Pentagon, and a fourth was still missing. We had been minding our own business, and now it was all gone. To make it short, the media got the story, and we started getting very visible. And one of the first things I heard after all of that was that there was discussion, because a few people with disabilities had died in the towers. Somebody said, we ought to pass a law that says that no person who has a disability should be able to work above the first floor in a building in New York City. And it was serious. So I happened to be at a meeting one day, and I said, I think it's a great law. I think we should pass it, but I only have one small amendment, and that is that we don't make any building taller than one story. Why is that any less logical than anything else? Because people have weird ideas about disabilities and blindness in specific. And I submit to you blindness in specific. The Gallup polling organization has proven that 76% of all people fear blindness over any other disability, and blindness is one of the top five fears we face. Blindness isn't the problem. Blindness may be the result, but blindness isn't the battle. Every single time you talk about what a blind person can't do that a sighted person can, all you do is marginalize blind people. All you do is create more fear among people who can see it. It's great for fundraising, but it definitely has a detrimental effect on our efforts to make it more possible for blind people to achieve their potential. Every time I hear about a child who has some eyesight, who may or may not learn Braille, but they're not encouraged or demanded to use Braille, even though they can read print if they put their books up to their face and they can read it at 10 or 15 words a minute, people don't recognize that the value of Braille is that that same child could learn to read it hundreds of words a minute. And they get a true written language that allows them to be more competitive, because we are so tied into eyesight is the only game in town. I can't tell you the number of ophthalmologists I've heard about who say to their patients, because I've heard about it from patients and ophthalmologists, the patient loses their eyesight because an ophthalmologist couldn't save it. We didn't have a cure for that retinal disease, and they became blind, and the ophthalmologist says, we failed. You didn't fail because the person went blind. You failed because we didn't give you yet the tools to cure the retinal disease. That's reality. That's what we have to deal with. But you know, with all of that, if I had the opportunity to see again, I wouldn't trade anything for my life that I have had. But I'd love to see again, because I subscribe in a stronger way to the Judy Collins song, I've looked at life from both sides now. I haven't had that opportunity. You haven't had that opportunity. You have never looked at life from the standpoint of a blind person who has been held to the same standard as you. And there aren't that many of us who truly have been held to the same standard, who know that blindness isn't the handicap, it's our attitudes that are the true disability and barrier that blind people have to functioning in society. But blind people aren't held to the same standard, so we don't get the same information and we don't get the same opportunities. That's not because of the blindness, that's because of the attitude. We need to change it now. We need to make it possible for blind people not to be in a situation where the government can allow organizations to pay us less than minimum wage, which is legal today. We need to be in an environment where no insurance company can do what insurance companies did for many years, which is not allow any blind person to get life insurance, because they thought that blindness was a risky business, and anybody who was blind had a higher chance of dying earlier, even though they had not one single solitary actuarial statistic to prove it. And it took years to fix it. We need to change the attitude that allowed Target not to create their websites so that a blind person can use it. And by the time that finally got settled, it cost Target $8 million, but it should have never have happened. Target should have been willing to provide that information and make their websites accessible in 2000 to 2007. And rather than paying $8 million to get it done, they should have been willing to do it, because what they would have done for blind people, they would have done for dyslexic people and so many other people who don't use graphics, and certainly who can't read print on a website, who use auditory or braille or other kinds of input. This is the time to make the change. This is the time to recognize the battle isn't blindness, the battle is retinal disease. Blindness may be the result, but we all deal with that. And it isn't all retinal disease. Let's make the changes that we need so that we truly, anyone who is blind, and I don't mean totally, but who has some eyesight, help us deal with making sure that everyone has the same opportunity and held to the same standard as everyone else. If we can do that, this will be a better world. I'd love the opportunity to see again, because I want to look at life from both sides. But I would not trade anything for my life, because as it is today, that defines me. And if I could learn to see and get eyesight back, that would allow me to get even a greater perspective of life. And it would allow me to be even a better source of information to help all of us. Come, let's work together and truly make it a better world for everyone. I want to quickly end by reading you something. This is called Guide Dog Wisdom, Lessons I Learned from Roselle on 9/11. And I want you to remember these, and you'll get it when you buy the book. Number one, there's a time to work and a time to play. Know the difference. When the harness goes on, it's time to work. Work hard. Others are depending on you. Number two, focus in and use all of your senses. Learn to tell the difference between a harmless thunderstorm and a true emergency. Don't let your sight get in the way of your vision. I am not visually impaired. I may not have eyesight, but I believe that my vision is as good as anyone's in this room. Number three, sometimes the way is hard, but if you work together, someone will pass along a water bottle when you need it. And that happened on the stairs in the World Trade Center for Roselle and me. Number four, Roselle's favorite, always, but always kiss firefighters. Number five, ignore distractions. There's more to life than playing fetch or chasing tennis balls. Number six, listen carefully to those who are wiser and more experienced than you. They'll help you find the way. Number seven, don't stop until work is over. Sometimes being a hero is just doing your job. Number eight, the dust cloud won't last forever. Keep going and look for the way out. It will come. Number nine, shake off the dust and move on. Remember the first guide dog command, forward. Number 10, when work is over, play hard with your friends, and don't forget to share your favorite Bodabone. Ladies and gentlemen, thanks very much.